We're starting. I am so glad to be here. When your youth came out to Engage Global and they were talking about Loysville and where they come from and how it's kind of rural and leaving Minnesota and leaving Minneapolis and coming here, they were telling me the truth. It is much more rural than where we live in Minnesota, but it is beautiful. And I think we probably chose the best time of year to come, huh, with the trees and the colors, the mountain ranges and stuff. So, Tom and I may stay a few extra days and just sit on Adam's porch and rock in his rocking chair and see the watch the leaves fall and then go home. So, but no, it is great to be here, and it's fun to meet some of you parents who let your kids come out to Engage Global, and we appreciate that. And I don't know if it was scary to think leaving kind of safety of your area and your neighborhood to come to the city of Minneapolis, or Murderapolis, as it's been called. We don't tell you that until after your kids have come. See, never would we say that before you let your kids come, but we can talk that way after they come. So, but no, we had a fantastic week. Adam put together a fantastic video. I think you showed that in church, and so maybe that gave you a little flavor of what we do. Now I'm going to kind of talk about that today a little bit, and kind of why we do what we do and how we do it, and kind of the philosophy behind it, and some teaching on that, and just kind of give you a background of myself. That's kind of what Adam asked me to do, is kind of tell you about my own journey a little bit. Maybe it'll be encouragement to you, and then a little bit about Engage Global. And we not only do we have youth teams come, we have adult teams come. So maybe some of you might want to fly instead of drive in 2 days. I don't know. But maybe some of you adults want to come out to Engage Global and travel the world in a week and see what your youth saw. So let me just pause and pray real quick, and then let me share. Father, I thank you this morning. I thank you for this church, and I thank you for the ministry that they have here in this area. I thank you for those that they've sent out and those they support, and for bringing the gospel and sharing the gospel in this area and around the world. And I thank you for this missions conference, for our speaker, and for the missionaries that are visiting. I thank you for the work that they're doing. And Lord, I pray during this week, as we hear things, God, once we know them, we're responsible. And may everybody, as they go through this week, as they hear from different missionaries, hear from the speaker, as they hear from you, may everyone be asking themselves, what role, what part am I playing in the big picture? I pray this morning, as we just take a little time to share, God, use me, I pray in Jesus' name, amen. Let me begin by introducing my family, my wife Nikki, and I have two daughters. The little one is Liana, and the older one is Lily. Liana just turned 7. In fact, right this minute, she's having a Princess and the Pea birthday party, pajama party at home. So I'm sorry I'm missing it, but in a way, I'm glad I'm not there. And then my daughter Lily is 16, both adopted from our time in Laos. Liana, we took home the day she was born, and Lily is 16 and just came into our family 3 years ago when she was 13. So 3 years ago, she didn't speak a word of English, and this year she's decided to join the Bible quizzing team, and she's memorizing chapters of the book of Acts. I'm just amazed by it, because 3 years ago, she didn't speak any English. A little bit about myself. I grew up in the state of Iowa. Has anybody ever been to Iowa? Okay. Wow, a lot of people have been to Iowa. There's not much there, is there? It's a lot of rural area, but it's not near as beautiful as this. Unless you like pigs and barns. Corn, yeah. The corn's not beautiful. No, it's just green and then brown and then, yep, then it's gone. It tastes good, though, right? But I grew up in Iowa, and I'm white, as you notice. And I grew up in a white family, and we went to an all-white church. And seventh grade, I started going to an all-white Christian school. And I graduated from that all-white Christian school, and I went to a Bible college that was pretty much all-white. And then I was going to graduate from that Bible college and pastor an all-white church. Now, not that I consciously was thinking that way, but I had never been exposed to anything else. I didn't know of anything else. That was my world. And then in 1985, I was doing an internship. I had come back to my home church to do an internship for the summer. And the church that I was doing the internship at was the church that had the Christian school that I had graduated from. And they had a long list of things for me to do that summer as an intern. I was going to work even a day with the janitor, teach a Sunday school class, direct the choir, just kind of get a taste of everything, all jobs in the church. But there was one man in the church who kept bugging them to go to the inner city and start some kind of an inner city ministry. And he kept pestering them. And I think the way the conversation went was, I don't know how we're going to quiet this guy down, but we do have this intern. And why don't we stick him in the inner city all summer? And that will keep the intern busy. That will keep this guy quiet. And so they sent me to the inner city. Now, growing up in Des Moines, we have an inner city. It's not as big as Minneapolis's inner city, but it's an inner city. And it was the area of town where I was growing up. I was always told, don't go to the inner city because black people are going to beat you up because you're white. Now, not true, but just the stereotypes that we get. So I stayed out of the inner city because I don't like getting beat up, right? So what are we going to do? How are we going to reach the inner city? How are we going to reach these kids? Well, I had the semester before, I'd been at a college in the Chicago area. This church had a bus ministry, and they brought 5,000 kids every Sunday to church on buses. And so I'd done a semester of bus ministry. I thought, hey, I know bus ministry. Let's start a bus ministry, and I'll go to the inner city, and I'll invite kids to ride a bus to church on Sunday. We'll bring them in on Sunday afternoon because the whole church is empty. There's a gym. There's all these classrooms, and everything is, you know, we got all this space. So the pastor the assistant pastor that was in charge of me for that summer sent his teenage son with me, and he and I went out to knock on doors. So how many of you ever went door knocking before? Okay, several of you. Yeah, you know. It was, my knees were knocking, and it was summertime, so it wasn't because it was cold. All right, I was scared. And I knock on that door, you know. And I think, man, there's going to be some big guy who's going to come to the door and just pound me, you know, because I'm knocking on his door. First door I knocked on, I waited, and nobody answered. You know, it's like, oh, man. Oh, but I got to keep going, right? I can't stop after one. So actually, it was a third door until somebody answered. Third door answers, and this girl comes to the door. And She was dark-skinned, but she wasn't African-American. So I said, you know, where are you from? And she said, I'm from Cambodia. So guess what my next question was? Where's Cambodia? Yeah, where's Cambodia? You know, I don't know if I either, they didn't teach me or I didn't listen well in geography class, but I'm like, where's Cambodia? And what are you doing in Iowa, right? Because my whole world was white, and all of a sudden there was this non-white person there, and it just was shocking to me. Long story short, by the end of that summer, we had about 400 kids coming on buses to this afternoon Sunday school, and a good majority of them were Southeast Asian refugee children, Lao, Cambodian, Vietnamese, and Hmong. And I found out later that Iowa, actually, when President Ford put out a call to all the states and asked the governors to do something about the refugee crisis, that the governor of our state opened the doors and actually started a state-funded Bureau of Refugee Programs and invited refugees into our state. And so we had all these refugees from the Vietnam War living right there in Des Moines, Iowa, a state that is about 90, or at least now, even after that, now is about 97% white. And that was my first exposure to people cross-culturally, of another culture, another race, from another country. And it was through that exposure, through that summer, that God just gripped my heart with the love for the nations and love for Southeast Asians. I mean, I found myself all of a sudden eating things I would never have eaten before. And I'm sitting on the floor and eating them, and I'm getting a spoon, and we're all dipping out of the same bowl of soup and eating, and all these things that I would never have done before. And at first it was kind of confusing to me, and I'm like, I don't understand what's going on inside of me, but I'm doing all these strange things, and I love it. And I actually talked to a missionary who had come through the Bible college, And I said, can you help me understand? Why am I, what's going on? And he helped me understand that this was just something supernatural, love that God has put in my heart. That was a very life-changing experience for me. And so I ended up pastoring for over 20 years in the United States, but I never pastored white people. I'd only pastored refugees, Southeast Asian refugees. And then as we moved to Southern California, I wanted to head to Laos in the late 80s. And we had planted a Loud church there in a Vietnamese and Cambodian ministries. And Asia just wasn't open, so I did the next best thing to moving to Asia. I moved to Southern California. That's the next closest thing. And we planted a church there and worked some different ministries. And then from there, ended up going to Southeast Asia and spending 4 years in Southeast Asia. But that first exposure was God gripped my heart and really put my life on a different course. And then there was a second major event that changed things. And that's when I took a class called Perspectives on the World Christian Movement. Has anybody ever heard of that class? Okay, a couple of you. It probably is much of what our speaker is doing. It showed me that from Genesis to Revelation, that the whole Bible, the whole story of the Bible is about God's heart for the nations and his plan to draw worshipers back to himself. And so that first exposure, and then I got that biblical education, understanding the story for the first time, those two put together really changed the course of my life. And so it was while I was in Southeast Asia, we were there among an unreached people group. We saw a church planted, the very first church planted among this people group. And we saw a English vocational center established, and a team was there. And I began to ask myself, I was in my early 40s by this time, mid-40s, and just said, God, what's the most strategic way for me to spend the second half of my life? And it was this whole thing of mobilization and helping awaken the church to the global task that Christ has given us and mobilizing people to be involved in completing that task. And so that's what brought us back and took us to Minneapolis. So that's what we're all about, is mobilizing people to go. Now, Jesus told us to go, right? And many people are going. In 1989, 120,000 people went on a short-term missions trip. How many of you ever been out of the country on a short-term missions trip? Okay, several. By 2008, that number had rose to 2.2 million. That's a huge increase in 20 years. And so though Jesus said, go, and many are going, the problem is not many are going long term. In 1988, there were 65,000 career missionaries sent by U.S. churches on the field. By 2008, there were 35,000. That's a huge decrease in the same 20 years. So short term, on the rise, but long term, on the decrease. And so I think there's a few strategic factors involved in why maybe sometimes our short-term trips aren't producing long-term missionaries and career missionaries. One is focus. As teams that go on short-term missions, out of necessity, because they don't know the language, they don't know the culture, they don't understand the worldview, they, out of necessity, are focused on meeting physical needs rather than spiritual needs. And when that happens, I think a couple problems come from that. One, it gives the idea that missions is driven by needs. And driven by needs, it becomes man-centered. And with that, we begin to focus on, or it hides what the real need of missions is in the lostness of man. It really broadens the definition of missions. Cost. A second factor is cost. Roughly $2 billion a year is spent on short-term missions. that's more money than is spent on missionaries that are living there, learning the language, learning the culture, and living incarnationally among the people to share the gospel and to plant churches. We often talk about the impact that a trip has on the lives of the people that go. Although research shows us that those impacts are not always long-term. And we don't often know the impact that it has on the recipients. And read some books like Help When Helping Hurts and Toxic Charity. And with that kind of price tag on a trip that's more for our benefit, it's really essential that trips are done right and we really evaluate how we're doing. Hosting. A lot of teams that go on short term they're not trained well, they're not prepared, they go with expectations that are maybe different than the missionaries receiving them. Sometimes the missionaries have to create things for the short-term teams to do. When those kinds of things happen, it really becomes a burden on the long-term missionaries to host the short-term teams. As somebody working as a missionary cross-culturally for many years, I've been on the receiving end of short-term teams a lot more than I have been on the sending end, both in the U.S. and overseas. And, I had teams, I worked in the U.S. among cross-culture among Southeast Asians and had many teams come, and I had many of the same kids saved year after year after year after year, to the point where I was like, I don't need any more short-term teams, because you don't come as learners, you come as teachers or thinking you're teachers, and you don't understand where the kids are coming from. I had a church that wanted to come. We lived in the inner city in San Diego working with Southeast Asians and gang members, and they wanted to come and do a skater thing. I'm like, my kids don't skate. They're gangbangers. They're inner city kids. But that's what they do, and that's what they knew, and they came with their own agenda. So it sometimes becomes a burden. Exposure. Typically, if somebody is going to be feel called to the world, they're probably going to go the place they first visited. Your first cross-cultural experience, that's where you first fall in love. Cross-culturally, you get an invitation to come back, and that's where people end up going. Well, more than 3 out of 4 people that go on short-term trips go to places that are already have missionaries, already have churches. And so then the outcome is we have, almost all career missionaries anyway, were first short-term goers. Not obviously all short-term goers become career missionaries. And those that do, how many were already on that track before they went on the short-term trip? So question becomes, with short-term missions, we just give up doing short-term. All these pictures that you see up here are taken in Minnesota, just as a side note. I don't know that we give up doing short-term missions, but we need to do a better job in tying short-term missions into the big picture. So let's talk about the big picture for a minute, and we're getting the big picture from your speaker, right? Amen? How many of you are seeing things maybe for the first time, the way the speaker is bringing them, that missions is in Genesis and in Psalms and Isaiah, and it's throughout the Scriptures? Amen? It wasn't just Jesus' last words, were they? No. In fact, when was the first time that the Great Commission was given? What's that? Okay, when he promised to send the deliverer? Yeah? And back in Genesis 1, he told Adam and Eve to scatter and fill the earth. Right? Fill the earth with worshipers, making his name great. Sin enters the picture, and that doesn't happen. And so, what does happen? He promised to send a deliverer after Adam and Eve sin, and then the world becomes wicked, and so he sends a flood. And then after the flood, what does he tell Noah and his family? Same thing he told Adam and Eve. Scatter and fill the earth. with worshipers, making his name great. So the people of the Tower of Babel came together and said, what? We're going to make a tower. We're going to build this tower to make a name for ourselves so that we won't be scattered over the face of the earth. And so what did God do? In Hebrew language, he scattered them, right? He scattered them. And then, what was his plan then? To draw worshipers back to himself from all the nations. Who did he call? Abraham, right? So from all the nations, he chose one nation to reach. From many nations, chose one nation to reach all nations. And that's then the storyline of the rest of the Old Testament, isn't it? As you're hearing this week. And then we come to the New Testament. Israel turns to idolatry and turns to those problems. And so Jesus comes on the scene and he recommissions, this time, the church. And what does he tell us in Matthew 28? Matthew 28, 19 and 20. Go into all the world and preach the gospel. Mark 16, 15. In Matthew 28, he says, go and make disciples of all nations, baptizing them in the name of the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. Right. So make disciples of who? Make disciples of all nations, right? We need to be careful there, because a lot of times we see that command as a command to make disciples. And somehow, because of all nations is a prepositional phrase, we leave it out. Right? It's not just make disciples of individuals. It's make disciples of all nations. It's discipling nations. And the word nations there in the Greek is the word ethnos. What's ethnos? What English word do you think comes from that? Ethnicity, ethnic group, or people group. So what's a people group? We might define it this way. A people group is the largest group of people through which the gospel can spread as a movement before it encounters barriers of understanding and acceptance. All right? So God told Abraham to be a blessing to all nations, and then Jesus told us, the church, to go and disciple all nations or all people groups. Anybody have an idea how many people groups are in the world today? Now, wait a minute. Did the Great Commission tell us to disciple all nations? Yes? So if you told us to disciple all nations, we probably should know how many nations that is, and we probably should know how we're doing at that, right? Because that is the task that we've been given. So how many nations? Over 16,000 nations or people groups in the world today. And research tells us that of those over 16,600 some, that about 7,066 are what we call unreached. Now, what does it mean to be unreached, a people group that's unreached? Now, that's different than unchurched. There's a lot of unchurched people around this area, right? That they're not believers. They need to be evangelized. And that's a responsibility of this church and other gospel preaching churches in this area. But we're not talking about unchurched people. We're talking about unreached. An unreached people group is a group of people, a people group that has no believers or not enough believers, not enough numbers and adequate resources. They can evangelize their own people group. And so they need outside cross-cultural assistance. So it's kind of like the state of Minnesota, all right? Minnesota, they call Minnesota the land of, anybody know? 10,000 lakes, right? Land of 10,000 lakes. All right, if I take a rock and I throw it into one of those lakes and the ripples start, yeah? And those ripples will go to the edge of that lake, but they won't jump into a new lake, will they? If I want to start ripples in a new lake, what do I need? Another rock, exactly. And so many countries in the world are like that. Like, for instance, the country of Laos, where I served. Laos is a country. Well, let me ask you, how much do you know about Laos? Laos is landlocked by five countries. What five countries surround the country of Laos? Vietnam, Cambodia, Thailand, Burma, and China. Yeah, good. You guys are good at geography. Laos is about 6.5 million people in Laos, and only about 3 million of those people are Lao people. And so that means the other 3.5 million are different people groups, over 140 different people groups altogether. And so the province I lived in is the province of Sien Kwang. There's two main people groups in that province. There's the Hmong and then the Lao Puan. How many of you know anything about Hmong people? Okay. Yeah. Your team's visited Hmong people. The Hmong people were our allies during the Vietnam War. They fought alongside U.S. soldiers. They rescued downed pilots. And then they came here after the war then as refugees, and many of them came to this country. So the Hmong people and the Lao Puan. The gospel came to the Hmong people in the province of Sien Kwang back in 1949. A missionary couple moved in there with a Lao pastor, a Lao Christian, and a Hmong shaman came to Christ. The day after he came to Christ, the missionaries had to leave the country for a field conference in Vietnam, and they were gone for a few months. And because of the bad roads and the difficult travel, finally, after a rainy season, they were able to get back. When they came back, they found thousands of Hmong people had come to Christ as a result of that one Hmong shaman. But it wasn't until 60 years later when a new missionary team moved in and brought the gospel to the Lao Puan that the Lao Puan came to Christ. And so over 16,000 people groups, 7,000 of them still are what we call unreached, have no access to the gospel, have no way of hearing. That includes a population of 2.99 billion people. 2.99 billion people that are living beyond access to the gospel, that will maybe be born and live and die without ever hearing even the name of Jesus. And then, just came off of Wycliffe website the other day to check these numbers, said over 1,900 Bible translations still waiting to begin. About 180 million people who, even if they wanted to read the Bible, have nothing in their own language. So, looking at the big picture, this is what it would look like on a map. If you look at this map, the green is areas of the world where there is established significant church presence. The yellow is where there's a forming church or nominal church. And then the red is where it is unreached, or where unreached, least reached peoples live. And notice the one area of the world that's primarily red. And what area of the world do we call that? What do we call that area of the world? 1040 window. Right. Why do we call it the 1040 window? Good. 10th and 40 degree latitude. It, right there, if we look at those lines, it provides a window right there. The 1040 window. So of those 7,066 some unreached people groups, almost 6,000 of those 7,000 UPGs live in that window. That's 2.91 billion of the 2.99 billion people. And it's the stronghold of five major religious blocks. So if we were to look at the 1040 window, kind of up close to the 1040 window, and look at the religious blocks there, we see it spells the acrostic thumb. We have tribal, we have Hindu, unreligious, communist, humanist, China, North Korea, and then Muslim and Buddhist. And it's, you see the countries that are primarily Muslim, primarily Hindu, primarily Buddhist. But tribal's not mentioned there. Why is tribal not mentioned there? Any idea why? We call tribal, we call it folk religion, we call them animists. Because it's everywhere. Good, exactly. Because a lot of places where Islam went, where Buddhism went, there were already local folk religion was already there, and they went in and kind of scooped them up. And so a lot of Muslims practice what we call folk Islam, or a lot of Buddhists practice what we call folk Buddhism or folk Hinduism. And so the Buddhist goes to the temple and chants and whatever with the monk, but they also go to the shaman. The Muslim will go to the mosque and go to the imam and listen to the teaching of the Quran, but they'll also go to the local witch doctor, local spirit person, to get help. So that presents us some challenging tasks to finish the task that Christ gave us of discipling all nations. The first task is this. The first challenge, I mean, is a spiritual challenge. Satan is got his grip on these nations, and he's deceived these nations, and he's not going to let go easily, is he? And they say that in the 20th century, there were more martyrs than all centuries combined before that. Not only has Satan, I think, deceived the nations, he has also, I think, deceived the church. In a couple ways, I think he's deceived us. One, he's really domesticated the Great Commission. It's easy for us to read the Commission, and many times we read the Great Commission as, go make disciples. In fact, you can look up mission statements from many churches, and it'll say something about making disciples. But the statement is not just make disciples, but it's to make disciples of all nations. And so he's really domesticated the Great Commission. Think about those two statements. Make disciples and disciple all nations. If I read the Great Commission as make disciples, do I have to leave home and leave the comforts of home to obey the Great Commission? Yes or no? No. I don't have to leave home. I can make disciples where I'm at. There's lost people here that need to be saved and taught to be a follower of Jesus. If the statement, if the Great Commission is to disciple all nations, do at least some of us need to leave home to do that and leave comforts and leave family and leave friends? Absolutely. And those who go, the rest of us have to send. If it's just make disciples, not only do I not have to leave home, but is it something that can be measured? 7 billion people, I'm not sure how we measure it. It's not really something that's finishable. But if it's make disciples of all nations, can we measure that? Well, yeah, research tells us there are over 16,000 people groups. These will have the gospel. These don't. We can measure how we're doing and how the progress is going. And can it be finished? Well, not only can it be, it will be, right? Matthew 24:14, Jesus said, and this gospel of the kingdom will be preached to the whole world as a testimony to all nations, and then the end will come. And John of Revelation 7 said, he looked, and behold, there was a multitude that no one could count, people from every, what? Tribe, language, tongue, and nation. So not only can it will be completed. People group challenge. 7,000 people groups beyond access to the gospel. Many of these people groups are isolated geographically. Many of these people groups have no written language and no Bible. And it's difficult to get to them. There's a political challenge. Many of these people groups that are unreached live in countries that we call canned countries. Anybody know what that means, a canned country? It's a creative access nation. So if you're to go to a country that is closed, a creative access nation, you can't get a missionary visa to enter that country. So you got to go in as something else. You need to have a different vehicle, some kind of a business, some kind of a reason to be there. The country of Laos is one of these countries. The country of Laos is still a communist country. You can't get a missionary visa there. You can't go in as a missionary. So you have to do something else. And you have to get a visa. So I was an English teacher. I went in as an English teacher. I was a real English teacher. I wore a tie. I knew grammar. I studied hard. I wasn't a tent faker. Okay, I was a real English teacher. I gave tests. I gave quizzes. I failed students. We were a real English school. But it was through that we shared the gospel and saw a church planted there in that place. So you saw the red coming through North Africa, the Arab world, Middle East, East Asia, some difficult places. I heard this once said that the reason that the unreached people groups that are unreached, the reason they're still unreached is because all the easy ones have been taken. And it's going to be difficult. It's a difficult challenge to go into those places. The financial challenge. Resources are kind of out of balance. out of every dollar given in U.S. churches, statistics tell us that 96 cents of that dollar stays at home. 3 cents goes into the areas of that map that were green, areas that are already reached with the gospel, already have churches. And only 1 penny goes into reaching people in the 1040 window. And if only 1 penny is going to that area, then I'm guessing not a lot of prayer is going into that area either. As the Bible tells us, where your treasure is, there will your heart be also. So we need to balance, bring some balance to resources. The missionary challenge. Out of every 10 missionaries sent out by U.S. churches. Now think about this. If you were a missionary and you knew that map and the task is to disciple all nations, and you looked at that map and you said, this is green, this area is yellow, this area is red, where would you go? Where's the logical place to go? Red, green, or yellow? Red, right? That only makes sense, doesn't it? Because if the task is to disciple all nations, and there's almost the majority of the task remains in that red area, it would make sense to go to the red, right? Yet today, research tells us that out of every 10 missionaries sent out by U.S. churches, guess how many go to the red? One. One out of 10 go to the red. Only one out of 10 go to the red. And then, the last challenge is the migration challenge. In Acts 17, Paul's preaching in Athens, and he says, from one man he made all nations of men, and determined the exact times and places where they should live, and he did this so that men would seek him and find him. So there's a lot of migration happening around the world. A lot of people coming to this country. Some come out of a pull, and some come from a push, right? Some come from the pull. Students come for education. Immigrants come for a better life, for opportunity, for the American dream. But some refugees and people are coming because of a push, because of persecution, and because their particular people group is being persecuted because of their race or political stance, and they're coming as refugees. Either way, they're coming. Between 2000 and 2010, the U.S. received 8 million immigrants just in that 10-year span. Immigrants make up 13.5% of our population. Minnesota alone, in the Minneapolis school district, over 90 different languages spoken. In the St. Paul school district, they say that almost 50% of the students in the St. Paul school district speak a language other than English at home. So they're coming. Millions of dollars are being sent from the U.S. to majority world to families of these refugees and immigrants. There are bridges and connections. So we need to look in. While we still need to send people to the unreached world, we also need to look and say, how can we reach these here and through those bridges take the gospel back to their country and their cities and towns and villages and families? So that's why we started this ministry called Engage Global. And the way we state our purpose is that we want to be a catalyst for the long-term engagement of unreached peoples around the world by providing intensive world Christian training. And we do this among unreached people groups from the 1040 window that are living in the Twin Cities. What is a world Christian? A world Christian is simply a world Christian is someone who knows the story of the Bible and strategically lives their life as a part of that story. Now, I think a lot of times the way we approach the Bible is the way we used to approach our high school yearbook. Now, some of you are younger than others, but if you can remember your high school yearbook, all right, when you got that yearbook in your hand, what's the first picture you looked for? Your principal? No. You look for yours, right? And many times, I think we approach the Bible that way. I grew up in church. How many of you grew up in church? Your whole life, pretty much. And I grew up in church, and my Sunday school teachers, I appreciate them. They were great. They taught me stories of the Bible. But I learned the stories kind of as individual stories, and there's always a personal application to those stories. And I never really saw how that whole, the whole 66 books are really just one story, with an introduction, a storyline, and a conclusion. And how that storyline is really, the Bible is about God's plan to draw worshipers from all the nations that He created. And so a world Christian is somebody who understands that story. And then they live their lives, strategically live their lives as a part of that story. You know, growing up, we used to ask the question, God, what's your will for my life? Right? Have you ever asked that question? God, what's your will for my life? And I think that's the wrong question to ask first. Because oftentimes when we ask that question, God, what's your will for my life? And we ask somebody, you know, go to counseling, what's God's will for my life? And what do people always say? Well, what do you like? What are you good at? What are you passionate about? What do you enjoy? And we say, well, I like this, and I'm good at this, I'm passionate about this. And so who does that make the starting point for finding God's will for our life? Us, me, right? So before we ask that, maybe we should ask the question, what is God's will? What is God's will? What is God doing today? And we know His will, from Genesis to Revelation, His will is that all nations, that worshipers from all nations, would come to Him. And we know that that is what will happen, as we, because we have the end of the story. And so the question we should ask is not, God, how do I fit you into my life? But God, how do I fit into your story? Way too many Christians, I think, are trying to fit God into their story. And many times we're like, what do I like to do? And like this, and like this. And so we try to find out what we like to do, and then we try to Christianize what we're doing. We try to Christianize what we're doing. But God never told us to Christianize our life. He told us to what? Crucify it. How do I become a part of God's story? How do I live His story? And so, really, that's what being a world Christian is all about. It's somebody who knows the story and lives the story. And that's what we are constantly pushing at Engage Global. We want you to know the story and live the story. So there's three components to the training we do at Engage Global. Is one, is that when teams come in, we explore God's Word. If I give you a bunch of statistics and show you pictures of lost people or even expose you to those lost people without a good Bible base, it borders on manipulation rather than mobilization. Mobilization must be Bible-based, must be God-centered, and must be obedience-driven. But I think many times our missions appeals are more needs-based, man-centered, and guilt-driven. Second component then is to explore God's world. So we want to go out, we want to experience and meet these people from the lost world and understand the bondage that they're in and the deception that they're under in these false religions and understand what it's going to take to reach them. And then once we've explored God's world and God's world together, we send you home because we believe that now you know and now you're responsible. And now you need to go home and explore God's work and find out how am I going to be involved in God's story. So we like to say Engage Global is a part of that process. It's a part of that process of helping people take those steps to be strategically engaged in the big story. And we're not a destination. It's not going to come back to Engage Global year after year after year to do your thing. You come, you learn, and now you go and get engaged. So why do we do this in the Twin Cities? Well, we have a tribal population in the Twin Cities. The Hmong people live there, over 90,000 Hmong. So not only do they have markets, but in those markets, they're selling up in the top right corner. You see the little idols. You see those horns. You see the symbols. All of those things used by the shaman to tell fortune and call people. The big picture, the rings there, when the shaman goes through his ceremony. All that stuff is sold there at the Hmong market. Hindus. We have the largest Hindu temple in North America there in Minneapolis. Within that temple, we have 21 individual temples patterned after temples in India. And so as your youth came up, does that look familiar? Does that look familiar, Melanie? Were you there? You saw that? Vishnu right there, the god Vishnu. So these temples house 21 individual gods and goddesses, and we learn about Hinduism from a Hindu. And because of that, there's a lot of Hindu ceremonies that go on. As my one Hindu friend told me, he might have said this to us, he said 330 million gods in Hinduism, and every one of those gods has a birthday. The Hindu calendar is very full. So there's always something going on at the temple. We have 150,000 Muslims there in the Twin Cities. The largest Muslim group are the Somalis. 77,000 Somalis live in Minneapolis. And so we have Somali museums, we have Somali mosques, and we have Somali markets. And then Buddhists. 70,000 Buddhists live in Minneapolis. We have the largest Cambodian Buddhist temple there in Minneapolis, built like a temple you would find in Asia, full of idols. And this stupa they're building right here is actually, they're building it to house one of the bones of Buddha. So who comes to Engage Global? Well, you guys. teenagers, college groups, and as I said, adult groups. Where do you stay? This is what Tom talked about, the hub. So Tom's family and my family, we live upstairs, and the bottom two units are where we host teams. And it's there in an area of Minneapolis called Phillips, about 90 different languages spoken around our neighborhood. This particular building, a neighborhood right there, 5,000 Muslims just in that one area. And then in the basement of each of the units, we have dorm rooms, guys' dorms, girls' dorms, bunk beds, and where teams sleep. And then you come upstairs to the living rooms. One living room is a classroom, and then one is a lounge. So what do we do when a team comes up? What do we do? We do missions teaching, both interaction and instruction. Then we do cross-cultural training. We do a game called Bafa Bafa. So how many teenagers here did you play Bafa Bafa? Was that fun? We divide you up into two teams, and one is the Batons, one is the Alphans, and you have culture you have to learn, and then we exchange cultural visitors. And you have to successfully interact in the other culture. Sometimes people get kicked out because they just are too offensive. And then we come together and we debrief. And the whole point of the exercise is to learn, how do I interact in another culture? So, there's some of your kids. And how do I interact successfully in another culture without being offensive? Because then we're going to go out and we're going to engage people in the community. That might be through temple tours. It might be in markets, talking with people. Adam's trying to talk this lady down in price. And I'm just kidding. I don't know. And then we eat ethnic food. So every day, every meal, we eat a simple breakfast at the dorm and then at the hub, and then lunch and dinner is at an ethnic restaurant. It may be they may set up a buffet. We may eat family style. We eat at temples. But eating food in connection to whatever religious block we're studying that day. And then we come back, and there's Salem. Then we come back and debrief and pray. So we come back and we talk about the day. We talk about what we learned, talk about our interactions, those kinds of things. And then we go to our prayer wall and we pray for unreached people groups by name, those 7,000. We pray for many, many of those 7,000 unreached people groups by name. So thinking back to those strategic factors, one thing about Minneapolis, you come up to Minneapolis and you might not be in a foreign country, but you will spend time in a foreign culture. But the benefit is that those in the foreign culture speak English. And so one of the things we do is we go to the Hmong market. Well, the province I lived in, Laos, has the largest Hmong population in that province in the country of Laos. So I've been to Hmong markets, Hmong market in Minneapolis and Hmong market in Asia. Not a lot of difference. Not a lot of difference, except for this. I go to the Hmong market in Minneapolis, and many people speak English. They live in the same worldview, but they speak English. And so my learning and engagement and learning of the spiritual need and the worldview and the culture really increases. Just to give you an example, I was talking to this young Hmong guy. And when a Hmong person gets sick, when something happens, they go to the shaman, and the shaman will put a veil over his face and shake those rings, and his spirit leaves his body, and he goes out and finds the spirit of the sick person, and to call that spirit back. and goes through this whole ceremony, and then he'll say, okay, you need to sacrifice a chicken and to appease the spirits. And so they'll go through ceremonies like this. So this one young Hmong guy, he told me, he goes, yeah. He said, the old people, they still go to the farm and get a chicken and bring it home and pluck it and do the ceremonies. He goes, us young people, we just go to the grocery store, we get a frozen chicken, and we offer that as a sacrifice. So they, even though they've kind of westernized, maybe modernized their ceremony, but the point is, it's the same worldview. They're bondage to the same deception. So you may spend time in a, not spend time in a foreign country, but you will be in a foreign culture. Cost, well, obviously we've eliminated international travel, visa, passports. You don't need shots to come to Minneapolis. You actually, we the week that your team was there, we traveled to Africa and to Asia and to India all in 1 week. Hosting, we design our missions trips for your growth and learning. So that is the focus. Exposure, all training is done among unreached people groups from the 1040 window. And the outcome is that after a week, you've got some good missions theology, some good missiology, and some good cultural lenses to determine the where and the why and the what of your of maybe taking a next step to going overseas. But whatever your next step is, it's to engage peoples, first of all, in your world where you can make a difference. We talked about all the immigrants and refugees that are coming here. And we have an opportunity to reach out to them. I was in Philadelphia airport several weeks ago, and I got there early, dropped me off at the airport. I got there early. I'm sitting in the waiting room, so I thought, I'm going to get some work done. So I'm just working away on my computer, not paying attention. 20 minutes later, 30 minutes later, I look up, and the waiting room is full there in the seating area waiting to get on the plane. And there was this Buddhist monk sitting there in his orange robe and everything, and there was this obvious circle around. Like, nobody wanted to get close to him and talk to him, right? And so I thought, I'm going to go talk to him. So I packed up my bags and whatever and sat down by him. And I said, excuse me. I said, where are you from? And he was from Vietnam. So we got talking. And he was from South Vietnam in the war. And after the war, he went to the Buddhist temple and he lived there and learned about meditation and all this stuff. And found out he had come here. And he'd been in the United States for 45 days. And he was traveling around teaching meditation at different Buddhist temples. So we talked. And I talked to him about, I used to live in Laos. And we talked about Buddhism. We talked about Jesus. I did my best to kind of share the gospel, ask questions, had a good conversation. At the end of the conversation, time to get on the plane, he told me this. He goes, I've been in this country for 45 days. And he said, you're the first American person that's talked to me, even though he's been traveling all over. And then Buddhists, you know, believe in reincarnation and past lives. And he told me this. He said, I think you and I were relatives in a past life. And that's why you've come to talk to me. So, I'm not sure about that. But the point is, we need to be reaching out to those around us. I have a friend in Kansas. He had spent time in Morocco with Muslims. He was at a store somewhere in his hometown. He met a Muslim guy. And he says to him, hey, come to my house Friday night at 6 o'clock. And okay, and so Friday 6 o'clock comes, guy didn't show up. 7 o'clock comes, the guy's still not there, so my friend decides to go out and look for him. Finally finds him at the store, and he says, oh, I'm glad to find you. I was concerned. I invited you to 6 o'clock. You didn't come to my house. And you know what the guy said? You were serious? He goes, I've been in this country 10 years, and no American has ever invited me to their house. Are you serious? How can that be? How can that be? So we want people to leave Engage Global and go home and engage unreached peoples in your world where you can make a difference and in areas of the world where no one is making a difference. 86% of Muslims, Hindus, and Buddhists don't personally know a Christian. They don't personally know a Christian. And of those 7,000 unreached people groups, there's another subcategory called unengaged. Unreached means it kind of gauges their response to the gospel that they haven't received Christ yet. Maybe they haven't heard yet. Unengaged means there's not even anybody there trying to tell them. It's a people group that has no missionary, that has nobody living there among them. 1,151 Muslim people groups have no missionary, even living among them, trying to learn their language and sharing the gospel. And so, what are we going to do about it? Now that we know, now we're responsible. So as you come through Engage Global, we have some other partners that are part of the process. We do take short-term trips. I'm going to Laos, back to Laos in December. We also have a Laos son, a foster son who came to live with us when he was 13, and he's now a missionary in Laos and working among his people group. We're going to do a prayer journey there and see in action. Cafe 1040 is another place where people can go and get into the 1040 window and get some experience. Close by in New York City, our national project of a 10-month church planting to teach you how to engage cross-culturally and plant churches. 1615 missions coaching for churches, helping them get a strategic missions focus. And, of course, good partners of ours, Pioneers and OMF, more long-term sending. So, any questions about Engage Global or about anything I said about what we do or about what your kids did? They weren't wild. They were good. Adam wanted to go out late at night and take them to see the city, and I said no. I said, no, let's keep him inside. And he was disappointed. But anyway, thanks. Thank you, Rick.